Right now, it is time to bring in our good friend David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. Of course, he is a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and he's got a terrific website, themediabeat.us. But we always love to have David join us on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Hello there. Here I am joining Marshall Miles again and reporting in from the media capital of the world, New York City. A columnist colleague of mine suggested that maybe I should vary my location sometimes and come a little bit more clean about where I am. He said that when we reporters, we media people talk about this field of ours, we should recognize that we are well in the center of, in fact, we're almost drowning in the New York media sphere, he said. So I'm reporting in from the New York media sphere this week.
All right. And boy, do we have a plethora of media reports and updates that we can talk about. I think the first one I'd like to bring up is the difference of opinion now between Pfizer and CDC. Pfizer says that, you know, they're going to need the shot around for a booster because they think it's going to be a good booster shot, even though they're working on another vaccination for the variant that's now out there, the Delta, which is so bad. The CDC isn't quite sure, but Pfizer says that a third booster shot would be really successful on people. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Sure, it's one to watch. I don't think it's easy for non-specialist journalists to make a judgment on this, but there's clearly shades of opinion here, and of course, why wouldn't there be? This is a very complex field, and I think we can be fairly confident that the CDC and the pharmaceutical companies will sort something out. They normally do, though. Of course, one of the distressing things about the American healthcare system as a whole is that so many of these decisions are swayed, major national policy decisions are swayed by the incredible influence that the big pharma companies manage to bring to bear on the situation simply because of their hugeness and their enormous lobbying power. The amount of money that they spend on promotion is a well-known horrific number, of course, but alongside that, the amount of money that they spend on political lobbying in Washington is also really horrendous. So with that caveat about, being careful about how much power we give over to the commercial interests in our healthcare system, I'd say that it will be an interesting one to watch just to see how the CDC itself decides in the end on this issue.
Well, the interesting thing about the issue is that there's a lot of people that aren't taking the shot because it is not fully approved by the FDC, and it's only an emergency use. And basically, I think the vaccine makers, and I think probably the president and everybody else would like the vaccine to become just a regular, not an emergency use, as it might push some of the people not taking the vaccine over the edge to get it.
Sure, and there are various protocols that you have to get through to be able to get any kind of medication or treatment or protocol accepted for general use rather than emergency use. So we have to recognize that we are still in an emergency situation, and that's been the truth from the get-go, and shows no sign of receding. If anything, we look like it's possible. Perfectly possible that we're on the verge of another really more serious emergency situation with another surge in the disease. The disease prevalent, of course, inevitably amongst people who are not vaccinated. So the vast majority of people who are succumbing to the new Delta variant in particular are, of course, the unvaccinated. So the combination of whatever it is, concern about the emergency status of this of of this treatment, or rather this prevention mode of the vaccine itself, or whether it's sheer obstinacy about not doing what we're being told to do. But that seems to be at the heart of what we're facing now. If we're facing another surge, it seems horribly likely. It makes a lot of overseas journalists who comment on this, who observe it from within the country, but reporting back to their other national audiences overseas, is that America's in another situation, rather like it was when seatbelts were being argued about. It seems that the common good doesn't necessarily always rule in America when it is weighed against this very distinctive notion of American individual liberty. The fact that someone is still prepared on a point of principle to not wear a seatbelt, put their own life at risk and other people's as well, is being repeated in a much bigger and more generalized way with this issue of people refusing or being that strange euphemism, hesitant about taking the vaccine.
Interesting story on the vaccines. Johns Hopkins has done a detailed study of the new variant and found out that every person who has died from COVID-19, the Delta variant, were unvaccinated. Not one person who received a vaccination has died. They've gotten sick, but they haven't died from it, and that is a pretty amazing statistic.
Yeah, well, in various venues, such as a court of law, the phrase "case closed" comes to mind there.
All right, now we have our little sound effect all set to go. If you're ready,
I'm ready for the fanfare.
The fanfare, indeed, ladies and gentlemen.
It's a fanfest for some really good and excellent journalistic work this week on grim subjects. It's not a cheering event, even though the sound is cheering. There's two events, in fact, and the particular journal, the particular organ of journalism that I want to highlight and single out for praise this week is the Miami Herald. One of the things that the Haiti assassination of the president has shown up yet again, whenever anything happens in Haiti, in fact, is how poorly prepared for coverage the media world in general is. Talk about the New York media sphere being something of an isolated and self-enclosed entity. Journalism has always found it, Western journalism has always found it hard to cover Haiti. Haiti is the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, and really a difficult place to get a hold of anyway, and a difficult place to maintain coverage of. And what we've seen is when the assassination happened of the President Jovenel Moïse earlier in the week, every journalistic outfit pretty much was on the back foot, but the Miami Herald was not. The Miami Herald has a long tradition of covering Haiti, and one particular journalist, Jacqueline Charles, who has connections with Haiti, has been the core of that coverage, and they've done a remarkable job covering and explaining what's been happening in Haiti. And we should say that this is all happening at the Miami Herald's newsroom at a time when the Miami Herald has also been holding the fort with spectacularly effective journalism on the collapse of the Champlain condominiums building, of course. And against that backdrop of extraordinary difficult and enervating, I would imagine, if you're on the ground, coverage of Surfside day after day after day, as we reach now the point of 64 people definitely recorded as killed in this terrible collapse, and still 70 plus people missing. And of course now that grim turn in the story that it's no longer search and rescue as an operation, it is recovery. That is the big story. It has been the big story for Herald journalists to be covering, but at the same time they've managed, like all good newsrooms have to, capable of switching to other stories and covering more than one at the same time. And their effort over this last week has been really stellar, and I wanted to mark that.
Well, you know, going to that Haiti story, it is a black eye for us once again. 26 different Colombians and two American mercenaries were those that formed that professional hit squad that killed the Haiti president.
Yes, and as the Miami Herald has been pointing out, one of they're both Haitian Americans and naturalized American citizens, and one of them is from Fort Lauderdale, that's one of the ways that the Herald has kept in touch with the Haiti story, every aspect of it, from the previous horrors of a dictatorship, and then followed by the troubled presidency of President Aristide, and the terrible earthquake in 2010, if you remember, that has set the country back horribly. I mean, it was always a difficult place, and with appalling problems, but all of them made worse, much worse, by the 2010 earthquake, and they still haven't recovered from that by any means. And of course, the rampant corruption in the country that has been allowed to continue despite all the foreign aid pouring in, and getting misdirected in many cases too. But the Miami Herald has kept its finger on all of those pulses by keeping good contacts within the exile Haitian community in Florida, which makes total sense, of course, and that's one of the reasons why Miami Herald does cover the Caribbean area and Central America so well. And this is yet another example. But yes, the discovery that the attackers are in all likelihood, if the Haitian authorities are right, a bunch of mercenaries, almost 30 of them, and two of them, as you say, American. That's something to ponder. And the big question remains, of course, is who were they acting for? The point about the mercenaries, as always, of course, is that they are in it being paid by someone else. They're not doing it for themselves. And the big question is that classic legal question in a courtroom, cui bono, who benefits from this? Who benefits from this might be the key to discovering who is responsible for the assassination.
You know, and we talk about the long-term effects of what's going on in Haiti. I think that President Joe Biden made a very good point this week when, once again, I think it was yesterday, where he came out and basically said the honest truth. We never went into Afghanistan to form a new government to bring them democracy. We went into Afghanistan to find the people that blew up the World Trade Center, that attacked the World Trade Center. I'm glad he mentioned that we are still pulling out, we are still leaving, because you know there's the old phrase: if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. I mean, the Russians invaded and had to leave, and the Taliban took over. We got rid of the Taliban once, then they came back. We're leaving now, and of course the Taliban is going to force its way in there. I mean, we were never, ever meant to go into a country and be there for, 20 years fighting a war and try to install a new way of life. That wasn't the reason we went into Afghanistan.
The message from the White House to the media this week has been constant, and I guess you'd call it consistent too. Fairly blunt, I think, is another way of describing it. But when President Biden acknowledges that that yes, the withdrawal will continue, and he recognizes there are huge problems being left behind. As you say, the point he's anxious to stress is that we, being the Americans, and all the American allies, of course, the entire NATO presence and the collaborative effort that has been involved along with the Afghan military, which has been overhauled in the process, it was essentially, from the American point of view, twofold. Topple al-Qaeda, neutralize al-Qaeda, and I guess, you know, the assassination, the targeting, the successful targeting of Osama bin Laden is one instance of that, and to ensure that the Taliban did not have Afghanistan to use as a training ground and a jumping off point for other attacks against the United States. Both of those war aims, if you can describe them as that, have been achieved some time ago, in fact, and that 20 years is just long enough, as I think he's been stressing very, very obviously, I think, kind of incontrovertibly. It is an awful long time, and he has done something that several presidents before him felt unable to do, which is actually do the pullout, and the pullout is being done and probably will be achieved before the rather poignant deadline date of September 11th. But in the face, you know, alongside all that, the blunt truth is there that this has enabled the withdrawal has enabled the Taliban to make enormous advances now and continue unabated taking over more territory. In one case, for instance, this week, attacking one town where there was a big prison that they broke open and freed hundreds of prisoners. We're not leaving the country in that much improved a state, although we may believe we have prevented Afghanistan from being a training ground and a base for a jumping off base for operations against the U.S., but we certainly haven't left it in any great state. And it's arguable about whether or not we wanted to turn it into a better country. I mean, much of the rhetoric over the last 20 years has been about human rights for Afghanistan, but of course human rights are not something you can impose upon a country, and I guess the Biden administration's point is that it really is up to Afghans themselves to do that now, and it has been all along, of course, but now they're not going to get the boots on the ground kind of help that they had in the meantime, which has not been all that effective, to be honest, in the end.
And I saw a great BBC report yesterday talking to some citizens of England who lost soldiers, sons and daughters and brothers in the war, and the reaction they had to the pullout of America. People seem to forget that it wasn't only Americans that went into Afghanistan.
Right, and Scandinavian countries too, and other members of NATO. Yes, the cost has been heavy. The cost has been even heavier, of course, for Afghans themselves. But the BBC is right to do that kind of review, and of course the same sort of review is being done by American journalists now, talking to American veterans and their families. The BBC too has distinguished itself by doing the best coverage it can from Afghanistan with its sometimes the media is hamstrung by the inaccessibility of certain countries and certain parts of certain countries, but in Afghanistan they've in the 20 years of covering it, and indeed the earlier time when they covered the communist regime in Afghanistan and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan before that, the BBC has a pretty good network of stringers on the ground, but they still don't. When they do the good work that they do, they're still very hamstrung, as I was saying, as journalism generally is. with Afghanistan. Coverage is not easy. They distinguished themselves this week, the BBC, by having a very substantive interview with the Taliban spokesman. But it's interesting to see that that did not come from Afghanistan. That came from Qatar, where the negotiations have been taking place, of course, the Taliban has a sort of well-recognized presence there, almost an embassy, if you like, in Qatar. And and what the message is, of course, is that they are dedicated to taking over the country again. That's a brutal reality that we have to acknowledge. And sadly to say, that is a very distinct possibility now as we leave. Whether it happens immediately, whether Kabul, the capital, falls soon, later, or perhaps never at all, we will still have to recognize that overall, Afghanistan is not improved by 20 years of blood and treasure being expended by America and its allies.
Okay, I hate to go in this direction, but I've got to go in this direction. When a certain lawyer came on the scene during Donald Trump's presidency, Michael Avenatti, I just...
A certain lawyer. I think I'm following you, yes?
I said to myself, you know, first of all, this is just too strong, the guy's too involved in himself. Anybody that deals with this guy better watch out for themselves. And well, guess what? He's been sentenced to 30 months in prison, and that's just for the extortion that he did with I think it was Nike or whatever. It just doesn't show what else he did to Stormy Daniels and everybody else. It just a despicable part of the saga of Donald Trump and the side effects.
Well, the side effects are still playing themselves out, and I think overall what we've got is in the legal area, both civil and criminal, there is much to watch in the aftermath of the Trump presidency, in terms of both the here in New York, the Manhattan DA's case against the Trump Organization, and ongoing investigations conducted by not just the DA's office but also the state attorney general, we're going to see a lot more coming out about the Trump world, if you like, the entourage with which Trump himself surrounded himself and continues to surround himself. By the way, did you notice his new press spokesman is in trouble already for an extraordinary degree of media incompetence? Some things don't change in terms of media effort by the Trumpists and the legal consequences of Trump's circles' actions, illegal actions in some cases, and that will get played out in the courts and through the justice system altogether. But of course, we're far from through with this entire story. I think that's one of the unhappy directions we have to follow. And there's going to be always something coming out of Trump world that is worth reporting on, like it or not.
Well, yeah, the residual effects of the, and I'm not saying the people that support Donald Trump, the 70 some million people that voted for him and will obviously vote for him again. It's not that. It's the fact that his residual effect right now is pretty amazing. It's going to be interesting to see what happens if any other indictments come down from the Trump Organization, and then see what happens over the course of time with all those supporters, whether he'll lose some or not.
Well, yes. I guess the big question is how many of those 70-plus million voters are hardcore supporters, and how many of them are people who just regard him as the best of the options available. That's a kind of grim commentary on political judgment in this country, but I suspect that I imagine that it's hard to make any realistic guess, but I know fellow journalists who've been pursuing the Trump conundrum, if you like, for a lot longer than I have, and at much closer quarters, bless them. They, on the whole, come to the conclusion that something like a third of that 70 million is hardcore and will not be swayed by any discoveries that come out, whether it's about election fraud or whether it's about the non-existence of election fraud or whether it's about actual fraud by Trump employees and family members. Those things are always a possibility. And whatever it is that comes out, a third will not be swayed by that information, but two-thirds might be. This is all very speculative, and as you know, I don't care for speculative journalism that much, but it's worth reflecting that 70 million is clearly not a monolith.
All right, and one final understanding of covering of the Olympics. Once again, with the variant raging in Japan, once again, the Olympics are still going to be held. But once again, this time, nobody, not even people who live in Japan, are going to be able to go to those games.
Sure, and already the media effects of that are sad almost sort of head shaking. One shakes one's head in almost despair about what kind of Olympic event is being forced upon us now. The Olympic flame got to its eventual destination and was lauded in a Japanese ceremony that was so desultory that it was, of course, that only word, sad. A few Olympic officials and some token media representatives witnessed this, and we know from memory what a grand occasion that always has been, and it can't be this year, and won't be. And the event, the races themselves, and the competitions themselves, will still have their value athletically, but they won't have any of the spectacle or any of the world involvement that they have traditionally had.
It's funny sitting here talking with you, David. It suddenly come to my mind that in a fast-moving world where information flies at lightning speed, if you take a look at the major enveloping news stories around the world, and that is the residual effect of the Trump presidency, the residual effect of China, the residual effect of COVID-19, the residual effect of Brexit, these are long-form stories that have yet really to show what they will yield in the future, and these are stories that are probably going to be around with us for a long time.
Well, journalism is often called the first draft of history, so we recognize that we're just scribbling away here and doing our best to capture the moment as it happens, but in the long run, of course, things will pan out very differently from what we might expect.
Well, once again, folks, you can follow David at his website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent, and we're lucky to have him every Friday morning. David, well, have a great weekend, and we'll speak to you next week.
Absolutely. See you then.
David Terechuk with the Media Beat here on Robin Hood Radio. You can also find David at robinhoodradio.com. Click on robinhoodradio.com. Click on, of course, our on-demand page, and then click on the Media Beat with David Terechuk.